have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. These statements are not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure, or prevent any disease. This notice is required by the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
This new Godzilla is unfriendly and is going to destroy your country. There's nothing you can do about it.
Isn't there anything job-related that you should be doing at this particular moment?
Welcome to the Medic Shack with your host, Chuck Hudson, a former combat medic, EMT paramedic, and currently a survival medicine instructor. And Kat Ellis, herbalist, herbal author, and preparedness expert. The Medic Shack is a place to learn alternative emergency medicine, what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. From minor wound care to moderate and complex trauma, providing instruction in herbal medicine, from basic antibiotics, antivirals, all the way up to complex tinctures, decoctions, and compounds. The Medic Shack, teaching you how to bring your health care under your control, no matter whether it's good times or bad. We will show you how to use your landscape to make your own medicine. We will show you how to take disaster, survival, and herbal medicine to the next level. The statements made here have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The statements here are not intended to treat, diagnose, prevent, or cure any disease. This notice is required by the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
Hey, Godzilla! It's over! You must forgive! Damn lizard!
All right, good evening. Welcome to the Medic Shack. It is a gorgeous Saturday here in New Mexico. Kat will not be with us tonight. She's got some family stuff she's got to take care of tonight. So we have Doc with us. Doc, how are you doing tonight?
I am well, my friend. How are you?
Oh, old? Well, not that old. Just my. It's not age, it's mileage on me. Just been teaching all weekend and helping a friend move and decided I got way too much. I can't be doing that type of stuff anymore. I need to, while we're talking here, I need to turn off a couple of things on Skype. So what's it like down in Mississippi right now?
It has been very hot. In the pre-show, you and I were discussing our various physical infirmities, and I think I mentioned to you that I had to drag my trailer 100 miles round trip down to the coast and back and spent an entire day bush hogging in the South Mississippi heat. And came back literally wiped out. I couldn't do my show Friday. I was, you know, it was hopeless. I was literally wiped out. I fell into the bed, and I don't think I woke up until 11 a.m. the next morning.
Well, I wish I could get that type of rest around here, but we're two teenagers, it's just not going to happen. Anyway, well, this weekend, Jacob is out of town. I can't believe it. Jacob graduates this coming Friday, and it's making me feel a little bad because, you know, it's like, wow, he's already 18. He's thinking about med school still. He's still thinking about med school, but he got a phone call for something that I told him he can't refuse it. He got offered a position at the fire academy this fall. You know, so that's really good for him, but it kind of upset his mom a little bit.
Why?
Because she wanted him to go straight into school and all that, and I said, you know, and the reason why is just because of the way things are in New Mexico. We have a lottery scholarship, and it pays for after your first semester and a half, it picks up all your tuition. Now, your books and everything else are on you, but it's still a really nice thing, and she was worried that he was going to lose out on that. You know.
Well, let me ask you this. Has anyone in your family been an actual medical doctor?
Trying to think back, no. Nope, nobody has.
In my humble opinion, and though I can't claim any personal expertise in the field, it's become a less attractive position.
Oh, yeah.
Over the decades. And it's one of those things because, I mean, I have a number of friends who are physicians and constantly hear them complaining about the excessive expenses, the increased bureaucracy, the increased regulations, and some of them quite frankly saying if they had it to do all over again, they would have chosen a different profession.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's what I've been telling Jacob, too. You know, not so much that, not to discourage him out of it, but see, he's kind of leaning, he's still looking at being a physician. He's got 4 years, really, to decide. He's still got to do his undergraduate work. But one thing he's been leaning more to, and he's probably going to do it, is what's called PA, physician assistant.
Right.
It's a much more, it's not as much money up front as people would think that as than a physician, because it's not a doctorate degree, it's a master's degree.
Well, is that similar to what are also known as nurse practitioners?
Similar, but a little bit different. Nurse practitioner starts off as an RN, and it's just an added certification that they take. They have to go to school for another 2 years for that. And it ends up, I mean, roughly the time in school is about the same. But you call a nurse practitioner a PA or a PA nurse practitioner, you'll have a fight in your hands. They
okay.
don't. They like, but realistically, what they both can do is very similar. There's hardly any difference in what they can and can't do. But the thing about PA, though, is the PA is not responsible for a lot of the, but doesn't get hit with a lot of the junk that a doctor does, a full doctor. They have all their, they have to deal with more of the malpractice stuff. It's just, it's just a more easier field. And in New Mexico, what's really cool is that PAs, nurses, and a lot of shortage medical fields, if you go to school in New Mexico and you decide that you want to stay here, and if you're willing to live in a semi-rural part of New Mexico, the state of New Mexico will pick up your tuition for you year for year. They'll pay for a year work here and for a year tuition. So it's a good way to get through medical school without debt.
Towards your eventual medical degree.
Right.
I mean, yes.
Well,
it's
just
not necessarily a bad deal.
Nope, it's not. You know, and so he's thinking about that and a couple of other things.
But on the other hand, I've got to point out, I don't know what the situation is in New Mexico, but I do know that in much of the Southeast, it is getting harder and harder to gain entrance to the fire academies.
Here,
and
too.
So
yeah,
what,
here. It's the same here.
What is a very typical route is for a man to spend, and generally young men, but to spend 1 to several years with a volunteer fire department and then hopefully sign on to a professional department and have them send them through the academy. And, again, it's not an easy route. There are a lot more guys who would like to go to fire academy than there are openings.
Oh, yeah. And in a way, that's what Jacob did. He's been a volunteer firefighter now at Edgewood Fire Department. So he's 18 for 3 years. So he's kind of like done his dues, paid his dues
right.
as a volunteer. And he's shown to be a go-getter. You know, he got his wildland certification last year. As still a volunteer, and it's a pay. You know, he had to pay for that class, and you know, so that impressed people. And, you know, he's a good kid.
And Chuck, I'm not making any claim to having been a professional firefighter, but many years ago, through my activities as a journalist, I'm sure you can relate to this. When you cover spot news, you tend to see the same firefighters and the same cops. At the same kind of calls, you know, the fires, the same accidents, et cetera, et cetera. And you tend to establish a rapport and grow friendships with those guys. So one of the volunteer departments basically had a little ceremony, I guess because basically I'd been on so many calls with them as a reporter. And I think you know me well enough to understand that I'm the type that's willing to get my hands dirty a little bit. So if I was on a call and they needed help hauling a hose or, you know, carrying a litter, I'd put the camera bag down, and I'd just lend a hand. Not trying to be in the way, just being a human being.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, yes, I can do my job, but I think somebody is in danger of death or grievous bodily harm. My personal set of priorities says that, you know, the hell with the story. I want to save this person.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way I am. Does that make sense to
you? Oh, yeah. Yep. I see. We got a few like that here in our area here. And see, I did time as a firefighter. See, prior to, well, I held two MOSs in the military, and I was telling Doc this in the pre-show, is my first one was I was a nuclear biological chemical warfare specialist. You know, your first couple of years you spent as a decontamination specialist, then you learn how to employ them. And one thing that NBC in the older Army is NBC techs, we had to take turns on the base fire department. You know, because we were hazmat certified and all that, and so we had to go through fire training. And fire training is actually part of the NBC school in the old days, and so we got to play around on firefighter, you know, as firefighter for 1 month out of the year. It was a lot of fun, and it's also extremely dangerous because drunk GIs make it even more entertaining. Oh,
now,
boy.
What I'm trying to do, bear with me here. I'm trying to bring up Survival Circle chat so that I can actually get some feedback from the audience.
Uh-huh.
And okay. I think I managed to do that almost seamlessly.
But, you know, tonight's show, you know, it's an interesting topic. And, you know, like I said on here, is that a healthy glow about you or is there tritium in your drinking water? And Doc was talking to me earlier, and tritium realistically is a very minor blip on the radar of radiation hazards. And this isn't to bash the nuclear power plants or anything like that, because one, I kind of like nuclear power. I wish that it was better managed would be a good word, Doc.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
But the thing about I wanted to bring attention to on nuclear, not so much nuclear power, but excuse me, on nuclear waste. And the reason why I say that is New Mexico, we have the WIP isolation pilot plant. It's a waste isolation pilot plant. We call it WIP. 2 years ago, they had a minor radioactive fire in it because somebody at Los Alamos mispacked a drum of radioactive waste and shipped it down there, and they packed it into the salt mines, and it caught fire and contaminated a good portion of the mine, and they're still trying to clean it out, which is fun because the mine is actually a salt mine, so it's porous. So it makes it a little entertaining to clean it out. But we're going to talk more about the different types of radiation, but the reasoning behind the show was that it was only this year that the majority of the hospitals where I live at decided to secure their radioactive isotopes and their waste isotopes. And we use some pretty, we use cobalt a lot because it's a great radioactive. We use americium a lot. And we have a lot of waste products of radioactive material. Anything, like when you have a patient with prostate cancer and we put these radioactive seeds into them surrounding the prostate, and it radiates it, and it shrinks it back down to normal size. But what isn't widely known is that everything that comes out of that patient is radioactive. When a patient urinates, when they defecate, they bleed, they spit, they whatever, it's radioactive. And on those patients that we have the seeds in, that during the time they're being irradiated until the counts go down, they stay in the hospital, and every time they have to use the facilities, it has to be collected, marked, and stored on site until right. It could be transported to a waste area. And it's those types of things that it's just worrisome. Because radiation is, you know, realistic. When I was an NBC NCO, radiation was the least of my worries of the N, B, or C. The biological was the one that scared the tar out of me. Radiation, you knew right away because you had some sort of detection device that right away would say, hey, alpha radiation, beta radiation, gamma radiation, X-rays, whatever. But with biological, you didn't know you were attacked for 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 5 months, 6 months.
I would like to bring up a couple of observations. And bringing these up, being fully cognizant of the fact that I do not have the medical background that you do.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we didn't discuss this in the pre-show
right.
prep. It's just something that I've been aware of, and I've had a hypothesis regarding for literally decades. And so I'm going to throw this at you cold and try to get your response.
Okay.
Okay? Now, let me bring the audience up to speed on something we did discuss. And that is that the general public tends to feel that the radiation age began in 1945. Well, or a little before that with the Manhattan Project and then the Trinity test in 1945 and the bombs we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that's what most people consider to have been the dawn of the nuclear age. Well, wouldn't you agree with that, Chuck?
Yes, sir.
Okay. However, that's not true. And here's why it is not true. I'm sure we have a very well-educated audience, and most people are familiar with them. Oh, people like Madame Curie and Pierre Curie, they were nuclear pioneers. They discovered radium, amongst many other isotopes. And roughly, and Professor Rankin, who basically pioneered the understanding of X-rays, the nuclear age really began in the late 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, mm-hmm. not 1945. So what happened is that you had this explosion of uranium mining, which in those days was primarily done to extract the radium and certain other isotopes. The dangers were very poorly understood. The regulation was virtually non-existent, and huge industries evolved around uranium mining. So, for example, World War I represented the first widespread use of combat aircraft. Are you familiar with that
right.
phenomenon, Chuck? Okay. Virtually all of those aircraft had radium-illuminated cockpits. In World War I, you had the first really massive use of iron or steel warships. You had the first massive use of submarines. Virtually all of these vessels had radium-painted pressure gauges and other instruments so that the sailors and soldiers could see in the dark. And, again, you had this huge industry evolve around uranium mining, which was then used to extract the radium.
Mm-hmm.
That was the beginning of the nuclear age,
yep.
not 1945 and the atomic bombs.
Yeah, it's about 1895, 50 years.
And, well, yeah, like I said, towards the end of the 19th mm-hmm. century, the beginning of the 20th century. And after World War I, epidemiologists started to see this huge increase in cancers. Now, conventional wisdom and contemporary wisdom to this day has tended to blame it all on tobacco. And the thinking was that, well, it was the huge mobilization of millions of men, and you had unprecedented levels of smoking. And I don't disagree with that. In as far as it goes, that is correct. And without any uranium mining whatsoever, tobacco does contain certain carcinogens. So don't believe that I'm trying to be an apologist for the tobacco industry. What I'm suggesting, though, is that is only part and not necessarily even the largest part of the story. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Ever so, for well over 100 years now, the Earth has been contaminated by various and sundry radioisotopes by the hand of man. This increased exponentially during the 1940s and especially after 1945. We're all familiar with the atmospheric testing, okay? So for decades, it's been known that there's not a square foot of Earth on the planet that is not contaminated by plutonium and or other isotopes.
Correct.
So here's my hypothesis, and no one does this, and I think from your experience in the medical field and in hospitals, you will have to agree. Whenever you have a patient who is deceased from cancer, or let's assume more happily they are not deceased, but they have a tumor excised from their body, okay? Virtually no medical facility does a radiological autopsy or a radiological screening on that tumor.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes into the biological waste bin. Am I wrong?
Nope, not a bit.
Okay. Now, again, this is purely a layman's hypothesis. I'm not a formally trained scientist, and I'm certainly not a doctor. But it is my opinion, perhaps you would call it a clueless opinion, that if every tumor that was excised, whether from the living or from corpses, they would find somewhere in that tumor a radionuclide which initiated it.
That's a really good possibility that, you know, unfortunately, though, we don't do that type of testing. All we do is what's called histo or cyto testing. We just look at the cellular structure. But I wonder if we've have if there'd be an instrument sensitive enough to detect that. But, you know, it'd be a...
There are instruments sensitive enough to detect it, but it is a time-consuming and very expensive process.
Mm-hmm. It'd be an interesting thing to see about that. Because,
but I doubt if in your career you've ever heard that subject broached, have you?
No, I haven't. It is, you know, I know that how we deal with the radioactive human waste, but, you know, I never thought that, you know, I actually never thought that, you know, we should look into a tumor in that fashion. Well, that's pretty interesting. Now, see, one thing about radiation, you see, what was that James Bond movie, Dr. No? Old James Bond movie was about 1963-64. Ursula Andrews, yep, looking good in that movie. Sean Connery. And Dr. No was messing with nuclear experiments on that island. And the island was contaminated. And so whenever they went in, they went through a scrub down. And one thing that's always bugged me about that movie, being an NBC NCO, is they went through the scrub down, which is right. It was shower, lots of water, soap, and then they hit them with stiff brushes. And realistically, that is, as an NBC NCO, I know that's the worst thing you can do, because majority of radiation in an area you're going to see is going to be one or two particular types, beta or alpha particles. The gamma, it's running at the speed of light. It's long gone. But beta alpha particles will be like, what is it? Alpha will be stopped by a sheet of paper. Beta will be stopped by what? A layer of aluminum foil.
Well, and they're persistent.
Right. They are very persistent. And, see, your skin will actually protect you from especially alpha emitters, where tritium is an alpha emitter. Radium is a very excited alpha emitter. That's why it glows so well. And plutonium is an alpha emitter, in addition to its gamma radiation, but its primary radiation is alpha. When you scrub down people with stiff brushes, you are damaging the skin. And when you open up the circulatory system, even with a tiny scratch, if that tiny scratch releases blood, you've opened a circulatory system. And you're going to...
Correct, and further contaminated the wound.
Right, you contaminate the wound. And when alpha particles get inside the body, that's where they do their damage.
Well, that's the big danger. I mean, if I can interject here for a moment, for readers who are not especially conversant on the topic, you can look at gamma rays and X-rays as basically being high-energy invisible light.
Yep.
Most of us understand that light is broken up into what we call photons. And X-rays and gamma rays, exactly like visible light, consist of photons. However, they are a higher energy, which is invisible to the human eye. Okay? So if you walk into a room and flip on a standard 60-watt conventional incandescent light, you are being flooded with photons. Now, these are very low-energy photons and, for the most part, do little or no biological damage to human tissue, including the genome. If you walk into that same room and turn on an X-ray machine or open a gamma emitter of some sort, you are being flooded with photons exactly as if you were with visible light. However, they are much higher energies, they are invisible to the human eye, and they are far more penetrating. They go much further through the body and other materials than do visible light, and they actually do cause biological damage, including damage to your DNA.
Yep. And the thing about gamma radiation, it's something that we found out in the space program. You look at the early spacecraft, the Mercury spacecraft, it was a very robust ship. It had very thick walls. It had thick aluminum shielding on it. And what they found out is cosmic radiation, which is a majority combination of gamma radiation, solar wind, X-rays. The sun is a really, if we didn't have the ionosphere and the electro and the Van Allen radiation belts and the magnetosphere of this planet, we wouldn't have a planet to live on. But when gamma rays, especially high energy gamma rays, hit metal, they cascade into secondary, tertiary type of radiation. And it can get really, really complicated, and you can get some really ugly things happening. But back to the alpha particles. And what's the alpha particle is what? A helium atom stripped of its electrons, or a hydrogen atom? Hydrogen atom.
An alpha particle is essentially a helium nucleus.
Yeah, helium nucleus.
And a beta particle is essentially an electron.
Right. And they, as Doc said, they're persistent. And the big thing about those is that your skin will protect you. You can actually stop the military M17 series mask or the new M9 mask or the M40 series mask will actually stop alpha and even beta radiation. They're designed to do that. Your standard HEPA filter mask will stop. It'll slow them down. It'll stop the alpha particle because they are, unless it's a very excited one, like an example off radium, it's just very, very dangerous situation. And I noticed in the chat room here, Lil again talked about having potassium iodide on hand. And potassium iodide is a very good thing. However, a lot of companies mis-advertise it as a quote-unquote anti-radiation pill. And that is very far from the truth. The only thing potassium iodide protects is your thyroid. And it does that only in the presence of radioactive iodine. It just blocks the iodine receptors of your thyroid so that radioactive iodine just won't bind to it. And it only protects you for that one particular type of radiation.
And the reason for that is because the thyroid naturally attracts iodine.
Correct. Yep.
Regular non-radioactive iodine, which is chemically identical to radioiodine. So the idea being, and you can actually do this with regular iodine. There are different protocols, but you don't need potassium iodine, potassium iodide or potassium iodate. You can use a solution of regular iodine from the drugstore and accomplish the same thing. But the dynamic is very simple. It is to get the thyroid gland to absorb iodine to the point where it's incapable of absorbing anymore. And hence the thinking and practice is that then it cannot absorb the radioiodine, and you are therefore basically immune to getting radioiodine-induced cancers. But as Chuck said, it doesn't do a thing for your muscle tissue, for your bones, for your heart, for any of the other parts of your body that are susceptible to other radionuclides.
Right. And there are just about every element in the periodic table can have a radioactive counterpart. And it's just due to us bombarding it with the right type of radiation. Breeder reactors are an example of how we create plutonium because it doesn't really occur too much in nature. But, you know, all the scary things about the reactors, I mean, Fukushima brought it all to a head because the reactor is still leaking, and right now the Japanese are doing a good job of controlling the tritium leaking out of the reactor. They extract it, and they got huge storage ponds for it. And like we said before, tritium is not a huge worry unless you drink gallons upon gallons upon gallons of it. It's a very low-energy reactor. In fact, I bet every one of our listeners here has tritium in their house and probably multiple sources of tritium in your house.
And they have tritium in their bloodstream, in their body.
Yep. And the tritium, most of the tritium I'm talking about is if you have night sights on your firearms. You know, it's just – and how many times have, you know, you sit there and how close is that firearm to you? To a lot of people, especially if you conceal carry. A lot of times, if you know, it is literally right next to your skin. And you haven't seen anybody conduct, contract a skin cancer from the imprint of their Glock on their hip or whatever. Tritium is not the biggest worry. The biggest worry about these things is, let's take Fukushima, was the radioactive iodine it released, the cesium it released, and the americium that it released into the oceans.
Even, and the strontium.
And strontium. And I think it did have a bit of cobalt came through. And, you know, these isotopes, like Doc and I were talking earlier in the day, their half-life is longer than the history of mankind. The half-life of it. Than the time it takes for the radiation to decrease by half. How about cobalt? Cobalt has a half-life of approximately 58 years. In 58 years, it will degrade 50%, and it keeps going on an exponential basis like that. You look at plutonium, on the other hand, plutonium is tens of thousands of years before it degrades. Now you're asking, how, if that's true, the uranium, was it, which one got the plutonium bomb? Nagasaki did, correct? Or with Hiroshima, they got the plutonium bomb.
Yeah, Nagasaki got the plutonium bomb.
So if that is actually true, that is tens of thousands of years, why is Nagasaki rebuilt?
Well, that's easy to explain, yep. Actually. The scientists of the mid-40s, those working on the Manhattan Project, understood the dangers of radiation to a much greater degree than we give them credit for. Now, they didn't wholly understand it, not in terms of the 21st century, but neither were they, shall we say, completely in the dark about it. And perhaps, Chuck, you're familiar with the difference between ground bursts and air bursts.
Correct.
Now, air bursts have certain advantages over ground bursts in that they, and for the sake of the audience, an air burst is designed so that no part of the fireball touches the ground, that nuclear fireball. And the layman might say, well, don't you want the fireball to touch the ground to create greater devastation? And the answer is frequently no, because of several reasons. If the weapon is detonated at a significant height where the fireball does not touch the ground, the overpressure created by the weapon spreads over a much greater area. So, in other words, it causes much more damage over a much larger area. The second reason you often don't want that fireball to touch the ground is because when it does, it produces massively greater amounts of fallout. And it does that through two mechanisms. The first is that the fireball literally melts and vaporizes whatever it touches. And it also contaminates it. Then you have a third, and it, when I say it contaminates it, it literally contaminates it with the molten and vaporized parts of the bomb that has been detonated. And the third problem with a ground burst is what is known as neutron activation. Earlier, Chuck said that virtually every chemical every non-radioactive chemical has its chemical cousin, which is chemically identical, but one is radioactive and one is not. And the most common way to turn a non-radioactive element into a radioactive element is to hit it with neutrons. Okay? So when that fireball touches the ground and anything that it vaporizes, anything that it comes in contact with, is subject to what is known as neutron activation. So that material is bombarded with extra neutrons and becomes radioactive, whereas previously it hadn't been. And that greatly contributes to the fallout problem and the contamination problem on the ground. So again, if you're a military layman, you might think, well, that's great. We want to nuke the SOBs and contaminate the hell out of them. Well, it's not necessarily true. You may have military reasons to want to occupy that land at some point in the future. You may have a port that you want to use to land your troops, to land your materiel. You may not want your own troops to be confronted with the contamination problem. So in many cases, the militaries do not want to use ground bursts, and they do not want to make the radiation fallout problem greater than it has to be.
Yep, and that's the primary reason why those airburst bombs were deployed over there. Because, like Doc said, 1945, you know, we think, 2015 or 2017, that we know so much more than those people did in 1940s. And realistically, we don't know that much more. In fact, we know less. The average person, not meaning to go on a tangent, the average person is less educated than the same age a person was in 1950. But all their talk of nuclear explosions, you know, is disconcerting. The real fact about it is full-scale nuclear war today is not as great as it was in the 1980s. Now, that being said, though, you have idiots like India and Pakistan that are fighting over a worthless piece of ground in between the two, and both have nuclear weapons, and both are perfectly able and have come really close many times to detonating them. So, and going into the radioactive iodine, I mean, into the iodine portion of this thing here, iodine, you know, too many unscrupulous vendors. They advertise potassium iodide. In fact, we saw it when Fukushima let go. We saw hundreds of internet ads of buy my radioactive radiation protection pill. And potassium iodide and its sister potassium iodate were almost impossible to find. Excuse me, didn't want to belch into the microphone there. That'd have been a party foul. But no, seriously though, on it's radiation though is a serious topic, and the biggest worry that we have about radiation is these goofballs that we put into power, called ISIS, or Al Qaeda, or any terrorist organization. Prior to when did the Soviet Union fall? Mid-90s. Prior to the fall of the Soviet Union had approximately 2.2 times the amount of nuclear devices that we did. Currently, though, they have not found all the nuclear devices because poor Soviet satellites that did have nuclear weapons inside of them somehow or another didn't turn them all back in. But even that is not our biggest worry. To me, now this is my personal opinion, our biggest worry is somebody detonating a ammonium nitrate diesel device in the middle of a big city and has that thing loaded with radioactive waste. And as Doc was talking to me earlier during the show there, neither one of us are exponents of nuclear power. Nuclear power is, if I was looking at Palo Verde's cost to operate, Palo Verde, which is a nuclear power plant in Arizona, can generate electricity at 0.33 cents per megawatt. And your coal-fired plants are about 2.4 cents per megawatt. Natural gas is 4.4 cents per megawatt. And solar is about 10 cents per megawatt. So nuclear is a viable option. But the problem with that is the rods, the expended fuel rods. And I actually asked this question in NBC school at Fort McClellan. I asked, well, if the rods are still radioactive, why can't they still use them? And I was educated by a very, very dour lieutenant colonel that explains, boy, if you pay attention, you see that the radiation is different and it doesn't fizzle. And I thought he was joking. And he's absolutely correct. It can't cause fission anymore. It's still highly radioactive, but it is not able to conduct nuclear fission. So
well,
say it again, sir.
If I can just interject a little something there. No matter how efficient the reactor design is, all of those rods still contain tremendous percentages of fissile material.
Oh, yes.
They just don't contain it in enough of a percentage to any longer be effective, okay? And so the French, for instance, made great strides in recycling their used fuel rods, the idea being that they wanted to salvage the remaining fissile material in the rods. It still makes theoretical sense. It is still a good idea. However, A, it is extremely expensive to do so. And B, it generates its own excess radioactive waste. So the powers that be did a cost-benefit analysis on this and also looked at the possibility of illicit diversions of the radioactive non-fissile waste and decided that that was not something the West wanted to pursue. The French still do it to a certain degree. There are pros and cons for both. However, the problem is still this. Even if you extract or recycle the fissile material in the so-called spent rods, you are still left with tremendous volumes of non-fissile radioactive material. And this goes back to what you talked about regarding a hypothetical ANFO bomb detonated in a large city surrounded by radioactive waste. It doesn't have to be fissile radioactive material. It can just be radioactive waste. And then you have a major problem.
Exactly.
So you go back to this whole problem, and this is another thing. It's true in the United States, and it's true of virtually all nuclear power plants around the world, at least 90% plus of them. They do not have viable waste disposable programs in place. So, for instance, in the United States, when they take the used rods out of the reactor, they store them on site. Now, they usually have to store them in water casks because they are thermally hot, and after a period of years, they cool down enough that they no longer require the water bath, but they're still intensely radioactive. And we have roughly 100 of these scattered around the United States, and most of the public is totally unaware of it.
Exactly, and those are the ones that cause me a bit of concern, because one expended power rod from a nuclear reactor. And we already know, and this is not to freak people out or get people all worried or anything like that or cause more hysteria in the planet, but we already know that most of these Islamic extremists are martyrs. They think they're martyrs. So they have no problem sacrificing 10, 15, 20 of these to cutting these rods up into smaller pieces and then detonating it somewhere. Now, with that nice little thought in your mind, though, what can you do to protect yourself from that type of device? And, you know, other audiences would write up, pop up, say, well, I'll take a boatload of potassium iodide. Well, you're going to have a very healthy thyroid, and the rest of you will be radioactive. There's only one thing that truly protects you from radiation: time, distance, and shielding. So,
Chuck, let me ask you a personal question.
Yes, sir.
And I'm not really looking for a specific location. Mm-hmm. I don't want your latitude and longitude. I'm just asking this question in very general terms.
Adams, Mason, Franklin, Gary, Ames, and Washington. Lee and Rutledge, Hancock, Wilson, Wythe. Sherman, Adams, Hall, and Rodney, Penn, and Dickinson.
For the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence and the 37 who signed the Constitution.
And here's to you, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help these fools that legislate. Rights away, our rights away. To know why you haven't read all the bills you filed. We'd like for you to read them for yourself. Look around you, all you see are patriotic guys. Stroll around the land, the brave and free go home. And here's to you, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help these fools that legislate. Rights away, our rights away. Hiding all your $1 trillion debt so we don't know. Hide it in your made-up FICA trust fund. It's a little secret just the congressman will know. Worst of all, you pass this debt on to the kids. They think we're fools, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help these fools that legislate. Rights away, our rights away. Ripping up our Constitution every afternoon. Give themselves a raise with no debate. Laughing at our founding fathers when they've got to choose. Everything they warned of's coming true. Where have you gone, Ron Wilson Reagan? Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Woo, woo, woo. What's that you say, Mr. Jefferson? The Gipper has left and gone.